And with our guest, Peter Lance, we're going to take your phone calls when we come back, so get ready. Plus, we're going to talk with Peter very briefly about his new book that he's working on, almost finished. We'll be back. Peter, what's the new work you're on?
Well, I'm working on a book on Ali Muhammad, and I'll just try and give you a quick overview of this guy. When I did the first two books, first I said, how could the FBI be this incompetent with respect to some of the extraordinary, negligence on the road to 9/11? In the second book, Cover Up, I found affirmative evidence that they intentionally, obscured this evidence on TWA 800, and then as I began to dig further, and by the way, George, when I go on your show, it's amazing. People send me emails, and I get sources that I never have. That's why your show is so valuable. And one of the sources I got started to tell me, lead me in the direction of the fact that the dots were intentionally disconnected along the way because certain people in the Justice Department wanted to cover up for their earlier negligence. So it wasn't like some vast Oliver Stone conspiracy.
Right.
It was CYA, okay? So anyway, I started looking, and there's a guy named incredible researcher named John Berger who has a website called IntelWire.com. He's based in Boston, incredible guy, and I credit him on my last book, and he's helped me a lot in terms of different aspects of the story. Here's how Ali Muhammad fits into this 12-year road to 9/11. I'll give you the quick overview. Ali Muhammad. The war on terror, I say in this new book, began the day Anwar Sadat was assassinated in 1981. And as you remember, he was on a reviewing stand in Egypt, and some radical Egyptian army officers jumped off a convoy, troop carrier, and killed him.
Mm-hmm.
And then, they were linked to the Egyptian Brotherhood, which was one of the early precursors to Al-Qaeda, if you will. Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri, who was the number two with bin Laden, was jailed, as was the blind sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman. They're all tightly, connected to Al-Qaeda. And Ali Muhammad was in that same unit, but he escaped. Why? What was his alibi? He happened to be at the John F. Kennedy Special Warfare School at Fort Bragg, teaching the Green Berets about Islamic culture at the time, 1981. He's so radical that Mubarak forces him out of the Egyptian army in the mid-80s. He then goes to work for Egypt Air for a year, where he learns every counterterrorism measure you can imagine in terms of air piracy. He then, right after the bombings in Beirut, where Hezbollah, the Iranian Party of God, they took down our embassy in April and then the Marine barracks in October. And then they kidnapped early in 1984 William Buckley, the station chief in Beirut. And that was particularly hurtful to William Casey, the CIA director. And they tortured this poor guy and they killed him ultimately. And so the CIA was desperate to get somebody who spoke Arabic, who understood the culture, who could try and infiltrate Hezbollah. Well, they recruited Ali Muhammad as an asset, and he went to Germany to meet with Hezbollah. The CIA story is that he blew his cover and they fired him. But others believe that he continued to work in some capacity for the agency because he got past a watch list and entered the United States. He meets a woman on the plane, George, marries her 6 weeks later in Reno, Nevada. He now has got a green card. He then becomes a naturalized citizen, joins the U.S. Army. Now, this guy speaks four languages. He's got two master's degrees. One of his languages is Hebrew, by the way. He's lethal. He's really incredibly fit. And he joins the U.S. Army, not OCS school, where he would have been more heavily vetted, but he becomes an enlisted man, goes to jump school in his mid-30s, and finishes at the top of his class. Where does he end up, George? At John F. Kennedy Special Warfare School, back at Bragg, with a secret security clearance. And what does he end up doing on weekends? In between being an active-duty Army officer associated with the Green Berets, although he was not in a Green Beret unit, he's going up to Long Island and teaching the World Trade Center bombing conspirators how to fire automatic weapons.
Oh my.
And that's just the beginning of the story. As it turns out, he later worked for the FBI. He literally moved bin Laden in and out of Afghanistan.
Is he a double agent?
He was a triple agent, man.
Yeah.
I mean, that's hence the name Triple Cross.
Where is he now?
Well, that's a question that few people know. Patrick Fitzgerald knows. Ali Mohammed was finally pulled over. Listen to this. In 1983, we know he's working as an FBI asset because the Royal Canadian Mounties grab him in Vancouver while he's waiting to pick up a Stone Al-Qaeda associate. And they sweat him. The Mounties sweat him for X number of hours. He finally hands them a phone number and says, call this number. I work for the FBI. They call the number. They let him go. So we know that he was working for the FBI.
Right.
But he was giving them crumbs, George. He was handing them Mexican coyotes. And meanwhile, he's learning the entire FBI playbook on Al-Qaeda. He was in Mogadishu when they shot down the two Blackhawks.
That's incredible.
He took Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri on two separate fundraising tours of Northern California. Now, understand the significance. This is like bringing Joseph Goebbels into America to raise money for the Third Reich at the height of World War II. Do you understand how audacious this guy is? So finally, he literally goes on behalf of bin Laden, and he's trained bin Laden's personal bodyguard. He goes to Kenya, and he's helped to set up the cell with Wadi al-Haj, and literally takes the pictures of the embassies and develops them himself so that bin Laden points to where he wants the truck bombs to go off. 234 killed, 5,000 injured on August 7, 1998. All right? Only then does the FBI pull him over, and they induce him to come to New York, and he's so audacious that he actually goes. He testifies before a grand jury and lies, and they arrest him right afterwards. Now, they keep him incommunicado for about 8 months under a John Doe warrant, and ultimately he plea bargains. And the judge is about to sentence him, and the judge actually says in the transcript, 25 years. Now, this is a guy who should have gotten 5 lethal injection death sentences for the number of people he's responsible for killing, okay? And they're going to give him less than 25 years, and all of a sudden there's a sidebar, which is sealed, so you don't know. And we don't know what kind of sentence he got. In fact, the evidence is that he's never been officially sentenced, but he's certainly not in the prison system. And he's in some kind of witness protection. And here's the final note that I want to leave you with on this thing about Patrick Fitzgerald, and this is why we have to be careful of those who lead us, okay? Patrick Fitzgerald is the U.S. attorney in February of 2001 who is now going to prosecute bin Laden in absentia in U.S. versus bin Laden, okay, for the African embassy bombing,
right,
Southern District. Who is the best possible witness against the greatest threat to our security since Adolf Hitler?
Ali Mohammed.
He's in the room, right, George? No hearsay, man. He's a co-conspirator. That's an exception to the rule against hearsay. He can say on the stand, look into the juror's eyes, I was there when, you know, the emir, as he called him, put the finger on the picture, right? They never call him to the stand. Why? Why do you think?
Because he knows too much.
Because if they put him on the stand, the defense lawyers would have peeled back the entire 12 years of negligence. That man is a living 9/11 commission. If Ali Mohammed was given immunity, it doesn't really matter at this point.
He could name names and everything.
Name names, George. He's a living. I'm telling you, put him in front of Congress. Put him. Give him a session in front of Congress. In open session, under oath, the American public can see it and say, Ali, roll, baby.
Is he in this country?
That's to be determined.
Let's go to the phones. You ready?
I'm ready.
We'll pick it up by going to our West of the Rockies line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, it's John from Vancouver. How are you guys doing?
Good, John.
Excellent. Number one, I think that you're bringing out some amazing information tonight, but I would like to add just a little twist to it, basically starting off by just saying truth is stranger than fiction, and the first casualty of war is the truth. And I think that, you know, given what went on, you know, you've seen cover-ups with Iran-Contra, you've seen Cheney stop the investigation on the put options, you know, you've got a scenario here where it's perfect for any global group to use Al-Qaeda or any other operatives through a false flag program. And I believe that this really is rooted in many governments around the world, and I just think that in general, you know, it put the shoe on the other foot. If the U.S. was invaded and tens of thousands of people were killed, what would you guys do? You'd flip out just like what's going on in Iraq. And beyond that, you know, corruption breeds contempt. And looking at 9/11, how does an airliner thread itself through highway lamp standards and disappear into a 16-foot hole?
Well, so, that's another story, and I want to see that video.
Al-Qaeda was used, and they're not great people. They're, you know, they're as bad as anybody, but, you know, Chinese got human rights problems. Why did they fly the Saudis out after the airlines were grounded? Why did the Saudis get flown out and the Bin Laden family get flown out? This is Illuminati. This is global. And they're trashing America just to create a global state.
Peter, would you believe that theory?
Listen, I don't want to disagree because I agree with many of the things this man has said. That's almost what happened with me with Alex Jones that night. It's
yes.
It's like there are many, many things that I agree with. It's just that I don't like to jump all the way to the Trilateral Commission point of view because I like to say what I can prove. And I think you'll agree, just listening to what I just said about Ali Muhammad, the stuff that I've been able to prove is pretty astounding. And what I'm looking for are specific goals. In other words, here's what I'm looking for. As Mike Levine said that night, I'm looking for a wedge, a legal wedge to get to the truth. We've already had the 9/11 pony show of the whitewash and the 9/11 commission, okay? What will ever get us to the truth? I say what could get us to the truth is if like a district attorney like Bob Morgenthau in New York, who's is one of the great, he's the prototype for Adam Schiff on Law and Order. You know, he's one of the great DAs of all time, and he's running for re-election. And if Bob Morgenthau had the guts to impanel a grand jury to investigate what remains the greatest open homicide in the history of America, right? 3,000 people dead in New York, and it hasn't been an indictment, okay? Except for Zacharias Moussaoui, which is never going to happen because he plea bargained, all right? Like Ali Muhammad.
Mm-hmm.
So if Bob Morgenthau impaneled a grand jury and called Jamie Gorelick in front of it and Patrick Fitzgerald and some of these other, Dietrich Snell, another player, they would flip just like any co-conspirator flips, you know, and they're not going to fall on their sword alone. And we would begin to get to the truth. And one of the things that Mike Scheuer said yesterday, and he's total agreement with me on, is that, you know, there were really a lot of great people in our intelligence community, the Nancy Floyds of the world, that were really trying, that were doing their best, and they were being thwarted by policymakers on high over three administrations. Again, this is not a Democrat or a Republican issue. And I, many things this man has said, I agree with. It's just that my little part of the world, I try and focus on what I can prove and see if I can get some effective change.
Remember Jack Nicholson in the movie Men of Honor? You can't handle the truth.
Yeah,
remember
right.
That? But
yeah.
East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yes,
this
welcome.
This is Mimi. I'm calling from Niagara Falls, New York.
Hi, Mimi.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
First, I want to say that I'm a faithful listener to your show. And as I was listening earlier tonight, I took issue with a lot of the things that Peter Lamp started out with, and I'm sure he'll take issue with me after he hears me.
Well, go ahead. Go for it.
Go for it.
Well, let me start by saying that no administration has ever claimed to be perfect, and I know there's, you know, a lot of problems in the world right now. That's stating the obvious. But, he started out, he's making all these comments as if he knows all this stuff, and I guess I kind of wish you would stick to ghosts and things like that, because when you have political commentators on, you really need to present the other side.
Well, we always do, but
well,
it might not be in the same show.
Well, yeah, so I'm going to present a little bit of my other side, too, if I can.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
If you'll let me. A couple of things that he talked about, you know, he said, well, I told you, George, I told you that, you know, there were no WMDs and, you know, 9/11 wasn't connected. And I just, if I could suggest some reading material for Peter Lance, because he does seem to be kind of part of the liberal media that's out there right now. If you would like to read the Weekly Standard this week, Stephen Hayes wrote an article about that very thing, about the link between terrorist training camps and 9/11, pre-9/11 I'm talking about. He's also written a book about it. And as far
does he
as
quote Douglas Fife? Does he quote whenever the neocons come back to try and still consistent, you know, even Cheney tried to do it 2 years after 9/11 to beat the drum to try and find this unfindable link with 9/11. They always, you know, Douglas Fife, Wolfowitz, they keep beating this drum. And
Mr. Lance, how do you know it's an unfindable link? What makes you the authority on this? That's what I'd like.
Well, I don't know. I've spent 3 years of my life. I've read 40,000 pages of every transcript in the Southern District. I've read every book on the subject. I've visited 7 countries. I've interviewed 300 or 400 sources. And I put my material in books that are fully footnoted. 1,000 Years' Revenge has 1,000 footnotes.
Yeah, well, Michael Moore has also written books and made movies that
found to be untrue. See, that's the classic. What you're doing is you're trying to tar me with Michael Moore's
brush. You know what? You're calling me a neocon and you're a classic liberal.
All right. Well, we both called each other names, but here's the thing. What I do is I stand behind my work. What I would ask you to do is look at my books. If you think I'm fabricating this information, I'll refund your money. Okay.
I didn't say you were fabricating. I'd be happy to look at your books if you'd be happy to check out the London Telegraph and the Weekly Standard and
send me the link. Please send me the link. Honestly, I'm open to the truth.
Okay.
There isn't anything I'm not open to, and if I'm wrong about something, I stand corrected. So I'm just, if you go to peterlance.com, hit contact. Give me the link, and I'll follow up with an email to you. I do appreciate it.
Deal. First time caller line. You're on the air with Peter Lance. Hi there. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Good morning from Fort Bragg, gentlemen.
Sure. All right. Hi.
I just want to inform Mr. Lance that his work is greatly appreciated, and even in the military-loving red state heartland of North Carolina, people are finally waking up to the lies and the idiocy of this administration. And keep up the good fight. The tide is turning.
Can I ask you something? I'm going to be in Bragg at some point in the next couple of months. And I wanted to say this, George, if you don't mind. Anyone that has ever knew Ali Muhammad, and when he was in America, they called him Ali Amriki, Ali the American. Anybody that knew him in the Santa Clara, California area, in the Fort Bragg area, that anyone that ever intersected with Ali Muhammad, if they could contact me on my website, peterlance.com, I'd really appreciate it. This is a guy who was one of the most remarkable espionage agents in the history of espionage, key to bin Laden, key to the success of the African embassy attacks, and anybody that has any information, I'd really appreciate hearing from you.
Okay, great. Thanks for that phone call. Next up, Wildcard Line, welcome to Coast, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Sir, hi.
I'd like to ask your guest, is he familiar with the book, 100 People That Are Screwing Up America, written by Bernard Goldberg?
It's relatively, what, when did that come out?
Relatively
new.
Right now.
Yeah.
Bernie Goldberg's the one that says the media is all liberal, right?
He was an ex-liberal, and he was in the media and worked in it for years, and Aaron Brown was on vacation, and today when he came back, he took him off as being his guest. And that is just the liberal media. When you said that this media is not liberal, every show, the only show the Republicans have is Fox News, and they're half liberal. And so, and they have all the radio, but who listens to radio? You know, I mean, a lot of people listen to radio, but who? But
so, Bernard
the news
was
is where everybody gets their main source of news from is the news.
Bernard was booked, and
they
dumped him.
Tear Bush down, and people's hate for Bush is so out there and so
it's
clear.
It's only by their hatred of Clinton. I mean, it's as George said earlier, there's such an extraordinary kind of bipolar thing going on. But I want to give you my own personal experience with dealing with the media. Bill O'Reilly, his program is produced by David Tabakov, who was my former producer at ABC News. We went to Fordham Law School together. I love that David Tabakov. He's a great journalist. He's tried to get me on with O'Reilly several times. O'Reilly won't have me on. Sean Hannity, Judith Reagan, my publishers published several bestsellers. He won't have me on. Nobody except for the Fox Morning people will have me on Fox News. Paula Zahn used to have had me on several times, and I went up against Tori Clark. Now, Tori Clark, the former Pentagon spokeswoman, she gets paid to go on CNN. When Lou Dobbs, who I admire very much, there's a general, I think his name is Graves, an ex-general, he gets paid to go on CNN. CNN has five or six former military and or Republican consultants that they pay to go on. What I'm trying to get at is it's very, very difficult to penetrate Fox News, even if you're working for a publishing company that's owned by Rupert Murdoch. So it's not, and I'm just giving you my anecdotal experience. There are many liberal individuals in the media, but they generally work for conservative companies.
We'll be back with final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Prophet Yahweh is not giving up. Beginning August 7th, the Prophet will start his 50-state UFO summoning tour. And during this time, UFOs will appear on the Prophet's signal for radio or television news and talk shows to film and photograph. So beginning August 7th, the Prophet is on his way to start his 50-state UFO summoning tour. He's well on his way, I guess. The After Dark newsletter is available to you where you get a great deal. You get it every month. But more importantly, you'll get a free CD. Classic interview, Art Bell's interview with Father Malachi Martin. It is called Perfect Possession. You can get it by calling this number, 1-888-727-5505, 1-888-727-5505, or online at coasttocoastam.com. A 50-state UFO summoning tour. Why don't you cover this, Peter, the UFO mystery tour with the Prophet? You can do that.
Yeah, well, I'm covering the Magical Mystery Tour and the War on Terror, and it's mystifying enough.
It's so. A lot of work, isn't it?
By the way, if there's time before the end of the show, if Lex could play Lives in the Balance, that's my favorite. Alex Jones will be surprised to know that's my favorite all-time song. You know, Jackson Brown.
This is not a request line, Peter.
No, I was waiting for that bumper music to come up. And anyway.
Wildcard line, welcome to the show. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, yes, sir. I'm glad to talk to you today. It's a pleasure talking to you. First of all, let me say I do believe that Peter is a patriot. He's doing what he thinks is right. However, I do disagree with him.
Okay, tell us why.
All right. Okay, go ahead.
Well, I disagree with the way the war started. I say the war started in Iraq because it's the same reason that cars get repossessed. Is Saddam Hussein did not live up to his agreement. At the end of the first Gulf War, he said he'd allow the inspectors to do their job.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
That's true.
And we went back, and he didn't do. He kept throwing them out.
He stonewalled it.
Yeah, and basically it's the same thing as you sign an agreement to buy a car. And you stop payment, the repo man's going to come and get your stuff, right? That's all George Bush acted as a repo man.
The other thing is, I think, first of all, I appreciated your fairness and kindness to me in the beginning of your call. Let me just say that I think you're right on the issue, but the question is, you can repossess a car by going in and sneaking into somebody's house in the dead of night and grabbing the car and taking it away, and there's not going to be an incident or a confrontation. You get the job done.
Yeah.
Or you can go in and blow up the car. You know, there's
a lot
of things you can do. And
but
I think that...
Is, see, go ahead. But what I think about it is, it's the same deal. I mean, we could not go in there with two or three people and take over the government. And, you know, Iraq is a big country. You know, it was the idea that we had to go in there with force to basically enforce the contract. That's all it was. I disagree with the way Bush did it, but that's all it was to me. It's a repossession of the country because he forfeited by not fulfilling the contract.
That's how it. Do you feel about the apparent lack of full support for the ground troops in terms of their equipment and...
I believe, basically, here's what I believe. I believe if you're going to go to war, you should go to war. If you're not going to go to war, you should stay home. I believe that sending troops over there without the proper gear was a cowardice thing to do. I think you should, if you're going to send troops in harm's way, you should give them every bit of stuff they'll ever need.
Right.
You know, I believe if you're going to fight, you're going to fight. If you're not going to fight, you might as well go home and say, here, just take over. No, that's it.
End up on agreement on that note.
I agree with that, too. Thank you for your call. International line, where are you calling from?
Hi, I'm calling from the oil sands capital of the world, Fort McMurray, Alberta. My name is Maureen.
Hello, Noreen. Go ahead.
First of all, George, may I compliment you on your intelligent and informative show. And, Peter, you have to be telling the truth because there has not been one stammer at all. It's been reported that this is basically a post-9/11 comment and question. It's been reported that since 9/11, our government computers have come very close to to being hacked into, and which is CSIS, which is basically the HAHA equivalent to the CIA, which of course would contain very privileged information, and very much so this has happened since the London bombings. This would in turn compromise anything from our airlines, means of communication, banking, to completely shutting down power grids and stopping oil production, which would leave us very vulnerable.
Interesting that Rome went down today, power-wise.
Yeah, and I mean, losing a couple or most of these things would leave us powerless and even more open to terrorism, basically open season on us.
What did you say got hacked into?
Government computers are CSIS computers.
What does
that
mean?
CSIS is our security.
Oh, the program, like the language or like the operating system, you mean?
The computers. And like also the airlines have been tied into it. And what our news reporters have said is basically like these people have been trying to hack in. And they know it's not your run-of-the-mill little backroom hacker.
Well,
have
they been able to, Noreen, get in there?
No, they haven't. But like this has been reported. So like what I'm wondering is this going on in the United States? Because, I mean, bottom line, our very means of day-to-day living are in the hands of the government. And, I mean, they're not informing us. Like, thank goodness for a couple of, well, quote-unquote, honest politicians. Like, but, I mean, like, how do you respond
well,
to that?
Well, I do know in this particular case, and I'll let you listen on your radio, Noreen. Peter, what did the FBI spend on a software program that did not work?
$600 million, the Trilogy virtual case file system.
Yeah, it doesn't work. And they haven't replaced it yet, have they?
No, in fact, that was another thing Mike Scheuer pointed out yesterday. It's astonishing. Can I say a quick thing about intelligence compromising in the war in Iraq, though? I mentioned this once on your program, but it still gnaws at me, George. In 1996, we knew Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of 9/11, was in Doha, Qatar, and they found that out because Ramzi Youssef leaked it to this mob guy, and he told the FBI, blah, blah, blah. So they sent the hostage rescue team over to get him, and they cooled their heels for a while, and then this minister, an interior minister of the Qatari government, who's still the interior minister, named Khalid bin Abdullah Al Thani, helped Khalid Sheikh get out of the country, get a new ID, etc. And he was a very pro, I've researched this, it's going to be part of my new book, he was very pro Al-Qaeda, this minister. Well, guess what? We located CENTCOM, the actual brains behind the operation in the war in Iraq, was located in Doha, Qatar, or Qatar, right? So why would we not think that we've been compromised, that these guys would know every single move? They've either got foreign nationals working there, even if they're, you know, maintenance people, or they put spike mics into the walls of the place. I mean, how could we have located in the country where they let not only let but helped the mastermind of 9/11 go, and that's where CENTCOM is. So every single military person that's listening tonight should be thinking about that, should be asking the chain of command, how secure is CENTCOM?
Wildcard Line, welcome to the program. Hi there.
Hi, good morning, George.
Yes, sir.
This is Greg and Susan Lee Finch calling you from Jaffa Place in Springfield, Virginia.
Okay, Greg.
And I'm calling because I have to agree with your very first lady call you had tonight about, you know, the type of show you're doing. We usually like to come here for an escape from all the political stuff.
Can't, you know what? I'd love to do that every night. I can't do it.
Okay.
And if I did, I would be irresponsible.
Okay, but then getting to my question then, Peter had said that you had done fiction 12 years prior to the year 2000. Right, and since then, I think that's what you've been doing, because I heard you say your idea for the cure of Iraq was to for us to pull out 100% and let them all fight it out and kill each other by the millions.
No, I didn't say kill each other by the millions.
That's what it would be.
Well, no, it wouldn't be that. And what I think is happening now is you've got a situation. You don't have any. There is no military solution that this government has today for winning that war, and believe me, they don't. There's no defense against the kind of insurgency that we have. The army has missed its recruiting goals 4 months in a row. There will be a draft in this country, despite the president's pledge. There's already a backdoor draft with respect to keeping the National Guard people in the reserves longer than their stays. So what I'm saying to you is, do we allow for a 12-year protracted situation where thousands more Americans die, or do we pull out and let the Ba'ath Party members kill the al-Zarqawi Sunni Islamists who hated each other prior to the invasion and are united now only in attempting to get America out? What I'm suggesting is thinking a little bit like Sun Tzu, the art of war, and strategically fading back for a moment, not betraying the people of Iraq, but thinking strategically about a victory solution.
I want to say this, by the way, just because a couple of people have called about format and things like that. It sounds like that when they hear stories like this, Peter, or shows like this, that some of them get up and you know, the hair in the back of their head pops up and neck. I had you today. Tomorrow we're talking about the soul and spirit. I've got Stephen Quayle coming in with a guest on Wednesday, and we're going to talk about the same nuke story that I talked with you about first hour from our guest Paul Williams. And then on Thursday I've got a witch coming on. So we balance the program, and you have to. 9/11 changed this for all of us.
Absolutely.
And, whether we like it or not, that's the way it is now.
And I think you'd be irresponsible if you didn't cover these issues, because one thing about your show that's so great, it really is a show about populism. It's a show that where most of your listeners are, whether they're left or right, suspicious of government power. A true conservative is suspicious of government power, and you give voice to those suspicions every night, and it's a great thing, George.
Let's go to our West of the Rockies line, your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Shell.
Hello, Shell.
Hi. I was wondering if you'd care to maybe comment on the London Times reporter who had the article printed, but it wasn't allowed in the United States, and there was a gag order. She couldn't comment about it during the 9/11 hearings.
Which specific subject was it on? I can't immediately recall what you're saying.
Nor do I. Do you remember who the reporter was?
You
or
mean
what
Greg
the
Palast, or the guy that works for the BBC?
It was a female reporter.
Uh-huh.
And she the Times printed it on the front page, and I understand that's the largest publication in the world, the London Times. That's what I believe I heard that. And it had something to do with prior knowledge of the attack.
All right, I don't think
Peter
can help you
that
on that.
One, I'm kind of at a loss, but thanks for the call.
East of the Rockies, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good, man. Sir.
Good.
My name's Rocco. I'm from Youngstown.
Uh-huh.
And you don't have to tell me about the ineptness and the laziness of our intelligence, George. I'm the guy that picked up the Reagan hitman.
Remember remember that. Okay, yep.
Yeah. Anyway, before my question, I got a little comment here. It's really true that they flew out a bunch of Saudis shortly after 9/11?
Oh, yeah, that is
that's
a true
really
story.
True.
That is an absolute
Well, that's got to tell you everything you want to know right there. That tells me everything.
Not only did they fly Saudis, they were members of the Bin Laden family and arguably material witnesses.
The excuse was that they feared for their safety if they were stuck here in the country.
Unbelievable. But anyway, my question is, remember, I think it was around 82 when the Israelis real quietly and efficiently took out a nuclear power plant.
In Iraq, by the way.
So why didn't we consult with their Mossad before we just charged into Iraq and using that foolish reason of WMD? Why didn't we consult with them? I mean, why are they our allies? That's what they're there for. And they're much slicker than we are. Simple as that. Do you agree? Are you there?
I'm here.
he's there.
The Mossad is a company. That's worthy of 3 hours on another night, I think.
Well, they're so slick, though.
They are very good.
They're very capable. They're very capable.
It's embarrassing. I'm embarrassed in front of the world. I'll tell you the truth.
All right. Thanks, Rocco. Appreciate your phone call. Let's go to our first-time caller line. A few more moments to go. Hi there.
Hi. Oh, great to talk to you, George.
Thank you.
Mr. Lance. I wanted to talk about the appellate court decision out of the D.C. Circuit involving Judith Miller. And, you know, my reading of the opinion sounds like they found a qualified common law reporter's privilege. And they didn't. And the Supreme Court didn't take the case because all three judges decided that you could either grant, either you had an exclusive privilege that you could protect the source, or you didn't have the privilege, or the privilege was qualified. And two of the judges said that they thought there was a common law privilege, but it was qualified, and that the bulldog Fitzgerald had overcome the privilege with his in-camera ex parte grand jury testimony, and because of the grand jury secrecy, that was the decision. And so it was really a victory for reporters, except for Judith Miller, who's protecting the criminals.
Well, and one of the downsides of this entire thing, though, is that how far does it keep going? I mean, is this just the beginning? Because, like as you said earlier, Peter, they may come up with other excuses to muffle other reporters. And what kind of fear do you have to put in them?
They will. There's no doubt in my mind that they've already succeeded, and I think they've chilled reporters already. And I think that it's just the beginning. I think if Patrick Fitzgerald can get away with putting a reporter for the New York Times away for 4 months, I mean, think about it. It wasn't the San Luis Obispo Tribune, which is a good paper, by the way. But you know what I'm saying? The New York Times, okay? And so if they can get away with that, they can get away with – they can. There's a chill. It's called the chilling effect. It's a legal term, and I worry. Because again, we're the ones that need to stir the pot, and we're the ones that need to be aggressive in auditing every single politician, Democrat and Republican.
Peter, tell us about the website. We got a minute left.
Yeah, it's peterlance.com. My name, Lance, and on there you can see FBI 302 memos drawing a direct link between the crash of TWA-800 and Al Qaeda back in '96. Not the missile, a bomb. And my first book, A Thousand Years for Revenge. And I appreciate, George, your fairness and balance. And anyone out there, again, that has any information about Ali Mohammed with M-O, Mohammed with one M in the middle, please contact me on my website.
And through the website, they can get right to you, get your books, everything else?
Yeah. And I've answered half the emails tonight already, the people that have sent. I answer emails. So, I mean, if people disagree with me or not, I respect their opinion, and I try and answer every single email. So,
well, you're going to be busy tomorrow morning. Thanks, Peter.
Hey, George, you're a prince, man. It's always great to be on with you.
Take care of yourself.
Take care.
He's a reporter. He's a good reporter. You might not agree with his views, but he does dot the I's and cross the T's. I'll tell you that. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Rob Ismail, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudisor, Ian Punnett, who's joining the Coast to Coast family, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on the next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.